Thank you for attending this session. It's number 316, Immigration and the Mormon Humanitarian Perspective. So that's how you know if you're in the right spot. Before we begin, same thing you've been hearing for a couple days, all of the cell phones need to be turned off, and please be respectful and attentive. The mission of Sunstone is to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging during the question and answer portion at the end of the discussion. Those who cannot abide by the guidelines should refrain from commenting and maybe ask to leave if they can't. And I'm pretty intimidating. I will take you out of this room. The session is being recorded. You'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor if you wish. If you haven't already, consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly towards keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session will be 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to remain within that framework. We'll start with each of the presenters will speak for about 10 to 15 minutes, and then the remainder of the time will be open for questions. The panel will raise questions about the LDS community's engagement with immigration debates and share personal narratives from the front lines of the political, legal, and humanitarian battlefront. The founders of Torchlight Legal will discuss how they are applying Silicon Valley innovation to the legal needs of asylum seekers. Two leaders in the immigration youth movement will share how they are training young people in the U.S. and Mexico to lead the fight for legal reform. So first, we will hear from Azul Uribe.
Was that close?
Can you hear me, Azul?
Yeah, I can hear you. It sounds a little bad the way that I can discern what you're saying.
Okay. Azul was a youth immigrant is a youth immigrant activist, originally from Cancun, Mexico, and Dallas, Texas. As an undocumented childhood immigrant to the United States, she is bi-national in spirit, but not on paper. In 2009, Azul was forced to return to Mexico and now resides in Merida?
Yeah.
In addition to being part of the Torchlight Legal Operations team, Azul now advocates for returnees in Mexico while she attempts to jump through the hoops her two countries have imposed on her in order to get an education. She blogs for Rational Faiths, FemWalk, and her own blog, A Guide to Belonging Everywhere, and has become an increasingly influential voice in conversations on race, ethnicity, gender, Mormonism, and immigration. After Azul, we'll hear from Jennifer Gonzalez. She is an information designer, immigration rights activist, advocate, and social entrepreneur. She is the founder of Torchlight Legal, a nonprofit tech startup that is developing a platform to crowdsource research and resources in support of asylum seekers. And then our final presenter is Joseph Wheeler. Joseph is the co-founder and CEO of Torchlight Legal, an experienced entrepreneur, and an avid storyteller. Joseph received his BA in History and Spanish Language and Literature from the University of Maryland at College Park. So we'll start with Azul.
Hi, everybody. It's good to see you on this Saturday morning. She mentioned that I actually was born in Cancun, Mexico. That's pretty much where it all starts for me. My family, I was born in the covenant, I'm gonna have to focus really hard on just talking. But I was born in the covenant, and it was really weird in a city like Cancun, because as you all know, Cancun is not known to be this mecca of faithfulness. It's actually sort of debaucherous. But, I mean, everybody thinks spring break when they see Cancun. What drove my mom to send me to the U.S. was actually spring break culture. and most opportunities. One of the things that happens a lot in Canton is there's a lot of American money, and so the locals get charged American prices a lot of the time, but we don't make American money, we make Mexican pesos. To give you a clue of what change rate is, $1 is 16 pesos. So right now. So it's quite a big gap. After an incident where I was prepositioned, you could say, as a 8-year-old by American spring breakers, my mom decided she'd had enough, and she sent me to the U.S. with my grandma. The first few times I went, came back hot. So I went at 8, and then I went back a couple years later, and I went again at 11. And that's when I stayed, definitely. But it was really strange because my family never brought up the fact that I was undocumented. Like, that wasn't a conversation that was had with me. And it's not like you're gathered together with other kids. No, they're talking about, oh, have you had sex talk? So that talked about it with other kids, but nobody talked about, have you had the legal paperwork talk? It wasn't something that occurred to me. I took English, I read English, I was Mormon, and, you know, I was fine. My paperwork was fine. I was American, as far as I was concerned. Fast forward to 2004, and I went to college in Cedar Creek to a liberal arts school called George Wood College. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. It's ultra conservative, like Glenn Beck loving, like, you know, tattoo the fathers on your chest type of school. I mean, except you don't tattoo them because tattoos are of the devil, right? Anyway. And I was the only Mexican in the entire school. I was the only brown person. Generally, this wasn't so weird for me, but for some reason in this environment, it became like hyper-highlighted. I would have people come up to me and say things like, I didn't know Mexicans could be like me. Like, I didn't know Mexicans like throw. And I was just like, how many Mexicans do you know? I mean, genuinely, how many have you met? And it was always like, oh, well, I know you. And I was like, surprise, you know Mexican three thorough. But people don't always take kindly to that kind of response. There's not a lot that's spoken in terms of like immigration and just that immigration is that. What ended up happening to me, I was babysitting 10 children for $60, right? Because it's service, and us Mormons, we do that. And so I think they were going, the fact was going to like some institutional like seminar thing, and I thought, no, God is really going to bless this because I'm helping these people get an education. But what ended up happening is one of the children had a behavior problem, and I ended up trying to control it in a very inexperienced way, because how much experience can a 20-year-old have or 22-year-old have in regards to that? So I ended up being jailed, and that's when it all started to me. To see fellow Mormons treating you like garbage is a really, like they say in Texas, it's a come to Jesus moment. Because suddenly you're having to really ask yourself how your brothers and sisters in Christ can treat you this way. You see the garment line under their uniform. And in my case, it's a lot of accusations, you know. I mean, you don't know you're undocumented. And I have to be like, well, I don't know. Or how can you have a real social security card, which I do from Idaho. And I always be like, well, I don't know. I don't know that. And in my case, it ended up being sort of horrible because it happened on my birthday. So after going to corrections, I was taken to the ICE department in St. Joseph's with the officers listening and fresh Limbaugh the entire way. So to say that these people didn't think very highly of people like me might be another statement. But what ended up happening while I was sitting in the ICE office, the officer, very obviously open, got very angry. And they asked me, you need to tell your brother to stop calling. And I'm like, he's my brother, he's worried about me, he hasn't heard about what's happening with me. And he's like, and the officer was like, but he keeps calling nonstop. He doesn't stop calling. And I just thought, I'm his sister, and he's worried about me, he wants to know. And he's like, I'm going to let you to your brother so you can get him off my back. It was such an incredible, mind-blowing experience, because on Sunday you hear, you know, how you should treat others and be kind and provide services. But Sunday was the fact that I happened to not win the birth lottery, and 4 ounces less meant that I wasn't afforded any of these. And it didn't matter that we were brothers and sisters in Christ, I also didn't get any of that compassion shown. So for me, my case lasted 3 years in the Utah court. And Amy, even though I spent most of my life in the U.S., the judge said I had no reason to stay. And I had to find something called a voluntary departure, which is basically about as voluntary as being at the end of a plank and being in the ocean full of sharks. I had to sign it, but I didn't have a choice. And so after not spending most of my life in Mexico, I came back without my family, all on my own. I spoke Spanish, which was a huge advantage to me. There are a lot of us who return who don't speak Spanish well. And I got handed a 10-year ban because I had stayed past 18 years old, even though I was brought in as a child. Immigration law is the only law that retroactively, which is still good, if you think about it. And this is particularly the case for grounds of academics. There's the famous conversation is phrased around European immigrants thought that Kelly Brown, they're foreigners, they're trying to make a better life. There was a case recently of German immigrant families that didn't want to their children to go to any public school in Germany. And so they came to the U.S. pretty much like undocumented immigrants. They came on a tourist visa and they overstayed. And the entire conversation around them was, these are religious people, they're God-fearing people, they're people who want freedom, and we need to, they're pilgrims. In my head, I was just like, they are no different from the people who mow lawns or baby the children or cook at restaurants or do any of those other things. But they get afforded, you know, humanity because they're white. White is the thing that we wanted. And so, for me, a lot of it now has been dealing with my Mormonism and the sons of my church, and seeing how they make arguments about protecting family when immigrant families are being actively torn apart and nobody's calling them to pass them. Everything they talk about in regards to why they're taking the public positions that they're taking should be for immigrants. I can't think of anything else more than the crack spoke mostly about immigrants. I mean, there's so much to that Christ teaching about how to treat foreigners, and every time the Bible is brought up, it's just for that one verse against gay marriage for some reason, and the Bible for family only to protect white families. The turning point for my family in regards to Mormonism and immigration, aside from everything that happened, is recently my mom, who's Orthodox woman, I asked her, what do you think that whose family is more wrong? Happening to us, the fact that I have sat down at the table for over 1,000 days and have seen your kids together, or two consenting getting married to each other? And my mom stayed really quiet, and she said, definitely what happened. There are families in detention centers. There are pregnant women without medical care in detention centers. There are children who are actively being put through, who come here seeking asylum for the drug war that happened in the country. We want to punish those people, but really everything that they're trying to do is get better life. And the fact that yes, Mormons have to embrace that is super surprising to me, because in our articles of faith state that Zion is literally in the U.S., in Missouri, in most places. I mean, I have a bunch of there, but it doesn't sound that paradise-y. And the fact that the literal rebuilding of Zion is happening in Missouri, and we are not allowing people back in, oh, I see you, is seriously, just maddening to me. You're pausing a little bit. Hold on. Can you turn your video off to the rest of it just so that we get a good feed? Yeah! Yes. Oh, wait, hold on. Alright. So I think that's a lot of the issues. Generally, I don't. My more urban side is my act. Alive, because there doesn't seem to be any place where the discussion is happening. Until recently that I met Jen and Joe, and suddenly realized that, hey, there were people who wanted to have that conversation because nobody else wanted to have it. And the silence surrounding this, even though there are bishops supported, even though there are families actively being supported, even the church has written an Arizona law addressed the sheep clothing, even though they changed missionary policy in regards to undocumented missionaries, is deafening. They're aware of us, they're doing nothing. And people are only aware of us insofar as, you know, they hear about us getting deported. To this day, I'm the only person that a lot of my friends know have gotten deported. For a lot of people in Utah, I would say, know have gotten deported, because I assimilated so well that I could be part of the conversation in an acceptable way. But that doesn't happen very often. There's a distance and a segregation between white legal culture and documented family. Like human beings, and it's that distance that we're trying to lessen, because if there's an acknowledgement of their identity and an acknowledgement of who they are, then maybe these conversations really start happening. Thank you. Okay. But I'm going to keep my off so that there's like a gate.
That works. Thank you, Asul. She is one of my favorite people. I feel very blessed to have known her. She and I met through the FemWatt groups and some of the other Mormon feminist groups, and she became our virtual administrative operations assistant and has been an amazing addition to the work that I'm doing. Yeah.
And she's still in Mexico?
She's in Mexico. She, yeah, so after she was...
Well, high level summary, I may not have gotten
Okay, after she was deported, she was given a 10-year visa ban in the United States, which means that she can't apply for any kind of immigration or visa for 10 years. And the reason, normally they don't give you a ban when you take voluntary departure, when you choose to go home yourself instead of being actually actively legally deported. But because she was a childhood arrival and she chose to stay in the U.S. after she turned 18, she qualified for a ban. So she actually, we attempted to put in a petition to get her a visa to come and speak here, but haven't been able to be successful. So that's why she Skyped in from Mexico. Osul's amazing. I feel like we could just kind of probably listen to her all day, but we'll have a group conversation here. I grew up hearing stories about my grandmother, who is from Germany, and her family left Germany in 1938. They were able to get visas to the United States just before the borders were closed during World War II. And they decided that, one, because their business in northern Germany served primarily a Jewish community, and their entire business was shut down when they weren't permitted to sell dairy products to the Jews. And my grandfather, there's a grand family myth about him running through the streets away from SS officers because he refused to salute them, and they thought maybe it'd be better if we left. And so those are the stories that my mother's family told. My father's family is fascinating and not nearly as mainline in that respect. I grew up hearing stories about my grandfather running away from Mexico when he was 15, and coming to the United States as an undocumented immigrant, and working his way from being a goat herder to a factory foreman, and then, because of some family issues, walking away from their life and becoming migrant workers in California. My grandmother on that side was Mexican and spoke Spanish, but was from a border family, so she was actually born on this side of the U.S. border in Artesia, New Mexico. And as far as I have been able to sort of untangle is from what we would call a mixed status family, where some of the family members are citizens, some of them are not, some are documented, some are not. What I've learned since then is that the border between the U.S. and Mexico for many, many years was incredibly porous. And just like you used to be able to go down to Mexico with just your birth certificate, people could come here with just their birth certificate. And the border communities were very much, the border is not really a thing until about 20 or 30 years ago. So I grew up hearing stories about my immigrant heritage. My father likes to jokingly say that, you know, when your mother's ancestors were crossing the plains, my ancestors were robbing them, which is almost true considering I have a great-grandfather who was one of the roving bandits in the Mexican Revolution. So yeah, there's some fun, colorful family history. As I grew up and considered going to law school, which is a totally different conversation than a long 10-year drama of how I swore I'd never be a lawyer and then ended up in law school about 6 years ago. The one thing I knew I was not going to do was practice immigration law. I was not going to be an immigration advocate. I wasn't going to practice immigration law. It was something that I cared about because of my connections, but the last thing I wanted to be is another marginalized minority woman working in public interest and social justice, making $30,000 a year and having absolutely no influence or power. Because I could do that all by myself without a law degree. I didn't want to go that route. Like I said, I resisted going to law school for about 10 years. I swore I would never be a lawyer. I worked for lawyers, and that kind of turned me off to the entire profession. In a long and twisted, sordid conversation with myself and my career, and quite a bit of divine conversation, decided to go to law school a few years ago, and was blessed with the opportunity to go to Stanford, which is, I still to this day am kind of shocked that I got to do that. It's an amazing program there. And again, I came in and I thought, well, I want to do good work, and there's a lot of support for public interest work at Stanford. And so I purposely chose not to sign up for the immigration clinics. I did not sign up for the Immigration Pro Bono Project. I worked on housing and other poverty issues a little bit. I got very involved in filmmaking and was working on a film in mass incarceration. And I decided at some point that we'd just gotten a new immigration professor who was the head of the ACLU Immigrant Rights Project, and I thought, well, you know what, I'll take immigration law so I can do pro bono when I go get a job at a big law firm and make some money for the first time in my life. That would be really awesome. And so I took the class and filed it away because I wasn't going to be an advocate. There are other ways to do service. When I was in my last year, I was working with some first-year students who wanted to do work on the film project that I was managing, and one of my classmates came to me and said, she's an Asian woman, and she came to me and said, I really want to do a film about dreamers. I want to do a film about youth immigrant arrivals and undocumented youth. And I said, great, let's do that. And so we took a camera, and we don't know what we're doing, we're lawyers. So we took a camera and some equipment, and we spent 24 hours on a blitzkrieg tour of the Asian American Legal Services volunteers, some of the students that work there, and a few other connections that she had made, and we interviewed six young undocumented individuals who had all received the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, in the last year, about their experience and about what it means to be an American. And my professional history really focused on narrative and storytelling. I have a master's degree in rhetoric and composition. I taught writing communications forever. Anybody who knows me is like, Jen's all about narrative. It's all about the narrative, right? And so this was a great opportunity to tell a story. And as I worked over the course of like 3 months to put this 10-minute film together and to hear these stories, I had a hard time resisting the pull. At the same time, I had worked the summer before at a law firm. I had done my due diligence, and I had found the one firm I thought I could stomach that had a really good reputation for being, you know, a lifestyle firm, so they weren't going to steal your soul. And I had had a less than stellar outcome with my experience with the firm and chose not to go to them to work or to any other law firm, and was trying to figure out how to forge my own path. And all of this was happening at about the same time. And I'm graduating and studying for the California Bar, which is possibly the most horrific, like, hazing there's known to man. And in this weird little twist of fate, the dean, who was a brand new dean, she had just started that year, and I think was terrified that she had an unemployed graduate. that's really what she gave me, what I like to refer to as my pity fellowship. She said, we'll give you some money to go out and work for a nonprofit and build up your professional resume so you can get a job. And when the faculty member who told me about this told me, she kind of chuckled and she looked at me and she's like, we know you can get a job, Jen. I've been working for 10 years. I have a 2-page resume. I walked away from about a dozen law firm offers. And she's like, so, but take the money. Go do something amazing. And so by another really random twist, I ended up in North Carolina working for a very small immigrant rights project. North Carolina is the fifth fastest growing immigrant population in the United States after California, Texas, Arizona, and Nevada. Nobody knows this. The Latino population there is growing, and it's enormous, and it's completely invisible. The vast majority of Latinos in North Carolina are first generation immigrants. They work in all of the service industries, as one would expect. A lot of the draw there is the building boom that's coming from the Research Triangle Park and the biotech industry there. So you get a very stratified community where you have lots of PhDs. The Triangle, Research Triangle area, which is Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, has the highest number of PhDs per capita in the world. And so you have a lot of PhD jobs and a lot of janitorial work, and not a lot in between. And so I got there, and I walked into this nonprofit that I had been led to believe was a slightly larger operation than one attorney and a part-time assistant, only one of whom was getting paid, and it wasn't the attorney. He was taking private clients on the side to fund his nonprofit work, handed me a stack of files about this big, and said, we have 5 asylum cases. I've never really done them. You need to help me figure this out. Because you went to Stanford. Marty, my boss, has an amazing reputation as a phenomenal advocate. He does defense against removal work, which is something that very few attorneys do at all, let alone pro bono. Say again? Rosenbluth. Well known. He's phenomenal. So I worked for Marty Rosenbluth for a year, and after 2 weeks of combing through files, he told me, oh, we have a hearing in 2 weeks. And so I learned asylum law real fast. And I spent a year trying to figure out how we change the system. When my money ran out at the end of the year, I should have gone and gotten a job. But I had been flying back and forth to Silicon Valley and working with another startup that was working in the, you know, employment, visa, immigration space. Everyone's trying to make money there. And I wasn't real happy doing that work. And I loved what I was doing, but I knew I couldn't do direct services forever. That's just, it's not my makeup. I get really burned out talking to people every day and telling them I can't help them. And so I started to build this idea of how we could get other people to help us. I had a moment, a woman, I'm going to call her Anna because I can't tell you her name, but she was from Honduras, and she had been abducted with one of her friends, and she was raped and beaten and shot in the face. And the gun misfired, and she lived, and she escaped, and she reported the rape, and she prosecuted it, and the guy was found guilty, and he was given, well, they said 30 years to life, and then when the sentencing came around, he got 6 months of house arrest, because his father was connected, and he was part of the cartels and the gangs, and the DAs told her she had to leave the country because they couldn't protect her, and I was trying to get her asylum in the U.S., and the day before our paperwork was due to the judge, I discovered that our 35-page legal file from Honduras was all in Spanish, and we'd been working from notes, and no one had actually written a translation, and we had about 48 hours. It was Friday night, and it was due in Charlotte on Monday, and I panicked, and I thought, I don't know what to do, but let's get enough of it so that we can pretend like we lost 6 pages, because this seemed to work in college. Oh, here's the middle, Judge. Sorry about that. And I scanned it, and I put it in a Google Doc, and I started Facebooking, calling everybody I knew that had decent Spanish skills, and said, just translate a page or two. Just help, like, anything you can do. And I have a friend whose mom is a retired Spanish teacher, and I have people who have mission companions who speak really good Spanish. And in a matter of hours, we had all 35 pages translated, and we had them certified. And that moment I went, wait a second. This is really cool, we can do this. And what amazed me is that every person who helped us called me back and said, I want to do something else that was really fun, that was really cool. These are not lawyers, these are not advocates, these are not anyone connected to this community. And they were so excited to help. And so suddenly I decided that maybe my job was to help them help. And that's how I ended up here and doing this work and embracing a level of poverty that I thought was over when I graduated from a top law school, and whatever. And working with Asul and working with Joseph. And I want us to have a lot of time to talk about some issues and questions, but the core of what I discovered is that if we are willing to work and we are willing to see invisible people, there is so much good that we can do, and it doesn't cost nearly as much as we think it's going to. So thank you.
Asul, can you still hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, good.
Uh-huh.
So as we talked a little bit before this conference, maybe more than a little bit, what my role would be here, we determined that the best thing that I can do is share my experiences of what can a white male do in this world, right? I don't have a great immigration story. I'm not part of that group inherently, right? But much like...
You did move to Utah from Maryland, which is a major culture shock.
That was... Maybe we'll talk about that later. But yeah, Washington, D.C., Maryland to Utah is a change. Nevertheless, that's the best I can do with an immigration story. So much like most of the people here, I have a lot of love, I have a lot of desire to do good, and I even have a few talents to bring to bear. But we're not always sure what we can do with that. In the little description, it says that we're applying Silicon Valley innovation to the legal needs of asylum seekers. And that's been a very interesting journey, because both Jen and I, we are somewhat accomplished, and we're very used to doing things in a certain way. We're used to putting it together, right? I run businesses, I do operations, I you know, you need things like money. Right? So we started this venture in the way that you would start any venture. We were going to take the efficiency of running a very tight-knit business, take the efficiency and the innovation of Silicon Valley and bring it into a nonprofit world, and we were going to succeed. We were going to make this happen because that's where our talents lie and that's what we can do. What I want to tell you is what we've learned in that experience so far. The first thing is that, remarkably, you don't actually need money to make things happen and to do good. You don't. And I wouldn't have believed that a year ago, but you don't. The other very cool thing of all the philosophies, and again, we want a lot of questions, so I'm going to do this very quickly. Of all the philosophies and the things that we wanted to implement in what we're trying to do with immigration, and particularly in asylum, the one philosophy that has come to the front and really been supported by countless experiences is that rather than trying to create systemic change, right, rather than trying to start at the top and, you know, oration and bravado and politics and legislation, these great ideas and how we're going to do it, you don't. You start at the very bottom. You start by getting to know Asul. You talk to her. And just by listening to the 20 minutes she shared with us, I again felt that, all right, right? So the marketing strategies of politics or any large organizations, you know, what we think of as immigration, they don't apply. And the reality is we like to think that, well, they don't apply to us, so she's kind of the exception. But the more people you know, I've yet to meet the marketing standard. I've yet to meet the person who's come here for the reasons everyone thinks or tries to convince us that they come here for. So we start at the bottom. We start with asking our neighbors how they're doing. We wonder where they're from. And that conversation turns into a way to help. Not all of us get the opportunity to spend our lives working on these things. Most of us have an hour or two, a month, maybe. But that's enough. What Jen stumbled upon isn't the right way to put it. The epiphany, right? The catalyst of what we're doing is, oh wait, when you ask people to do just a little bit of good, and you ask a lot of them to do a little bit of good, you can do a lot. The metaphor in my mind that keeps repeating itself is a field of dry grass. I mean, you toss a match in it, and it goes. You can learn a lot more if you're interested to. But it's very possible, without being part of that group, to do a lot of good. And that's where I've come from here. Thank you.
All right. It looks like we have lost my clock. It looks like we have about 20 minutes for questions. The session is being recorded, so we'll need to use this microphone to ask questions. And it doesn't move very far, so you'll need to come up here. And use the microphone if you have. Use the microphone if you have a question. You're gonna be blinded.
Stretch.
Nope.
Sorry.
Let's tape to the floor. I think.
Get around here.
Sorry.
My question was that Asul mentioned that she mentioned an article of faith that talks about you know, the literal gathering of Zion. And then there's another article of faith that I think conflicts with that, which is that we believe in upholding and sustaining the law, and I would assume that includes immigration law. I had a friend who was who crossed the border into Arizona. He was from Peru. He came all the way a long story, but he ended up in Mexico and crossed the border illegally into Arizona. And he was LDS, served a mission. The first thing he thought to do once he got to Tucson, because he didn't have any contacts, was to call the LDS church in the phone book. So he looked it up, called the bishop, talked to him, and picked him up to take him to church. But on the way, he realized, wait, this guy's illegal. And the bishop locked the doors and drove him back across Mexico and kicked him out of the car and drove back. So he's deported by his own bishop. I'm just wondering, like, what... if you could talk more about the Mormon involvement in this, what do Mormons think about immigration, and how can, because it seems like the church recently came out in 2011 with a statement that kind of all of a sudden overnight swung everyone's opinions, oh, we got to keep the families together now. But it seems like Mormons tend to be very Republican at the same time, and so, I don't know, it just seems like a very... conflicting and an interesting area to be talking about immigration.
Conflicting is a really good word. Asul, I want you to weigh in on this, but I want to point out.
That article that you mentioned, everybody always brings it up. They're like, how come these people are getting temple recommend? You know, there's that article that they talk about obeying the law. But actually, in the 90s, there were so many undocumented priesthood holders that they just had a whole bunch of districts where they could have had branches and wards. So the church became aware of that and actually took off that restriction. It's funny that people always mention that, because the Mormons who mention that are the ones who are like the least about doing that. I mean, right now that the SCOTUS judgment came back and everybody could get married, you have people denying marriage licenses, and if we're all about upholding that law all over the place, then it should be all the time, right? Not just, it shouldn't be like pick and choose which law you serve. The other issue is that a lot of the reasons why people are fleeing to the States are because, and no offense to any Americans, like, I'm still all about that 4th of July, but Americans are coming to sort of like ruining our country. And I'm not saying this to be sort of like angry, but for example, where I live in Canada, there are so many American expats coming to live here that the property prices have gone up ridiculously for us.
And most of them are not illegal immigrants to Mexico.
In Mexico, and that just happened in a lot of Southern American countries. The drug wars that are happening, I mean, the people buying these drugs are mostly American people. It's not like magically, you know. So there's a lot of like American ways, for lack of a better word, that are ruining our way of life. And we're trying to find a better way. I mean, if we're going to be charged in dollars, we might as well be making them, right? Because our governments aren't going to pay us in dollars. So we go and we try to work there. I know for my family, it was very much like, okay, my mom might not be around this environment where people are harassing them all the time. And she had two daughters and my older brother. And so she was like, well, I'll just take them to the States. You know, people are nice there, right? And there's a whole bunch of Mormons, so it can be an issue. We're Mormon. In regards to the church, I feel like the church knows enough about us that they make little tweaks to protect themselves and then basically wash their hands clean. In 2007, I think, there was a missionary who finished serving his mission, and as soon as he landed home, he got handcuffed and shipped back. And after that, the church put in the rule that if there were undocumented missionaries serving, they were not to travel by plane at all. They were only to travel by bus wherever they were going in the States. And they were not to talk about it with their companions and not their mission president. You have the Utah Compact, which they tried to come out with, which is basically just protecting Utah businesses from buying if they happen to hire undocumented workers. Well, who's the biggest place hiring in Utah? The church. Little but they don't do anything. And in the context of Mormonism, it's like, well, you know, it's really a feature, you're not obeying the law. Well, cool, go please stop screwing up my country. Just a thing that enraged me a few months ago. I was going to Mexico City and I wanted to see some of the sights because I'm a Mexican and I'm visiting Mexico City. But stupid James Bond was reporting and like half of tourist sites were closed because Daniel Craig had to jump around or whatever. Or I don't know what James Bond is, I guess he shoots people. But the thing is, I was like, I can't even enjoy my own country because they're coming over here and like taking over everything with Columbus. No offense. So you know, I don't even have the joy of my own country. I don't have the joy to control my own team. And that happens a lot here. People go over there thinking, well, you know, maybe I can make it work a little bit. If Americans didn't come and Europeans didn't come and, you know, take over so much of things, these people would be allowed to build a little bit here, but we're not. So that seems a little bit all over the place, but I just wanted to discuss that real quick. And the article, thank you much, I have my friend who's like, she's like, okay, we're talking about immigration, let's count down to see when a white person whips that out. So,
yeah. Thank you, Asul. I think as an attorney and someone who studied the law, and as a Mormon, I think there's a difference between respecting the rule of law and appreciating that if a law does not reflect core fundamental human rights and values, that we need to think a little bit differently about how we interpret those laws. There's a lot of assumption that the law is clean and that it's exact and that it's well applied in every circumstance. And when you study the law, you realize that's absolutely fundamentally never true. When you study immigration law, what you find is this beautiful, well-documented history of racism and xenophobia in the United States. One of the most significant pieces of legislation in the 1800s as they began to create actual immigration limitations is, and I'm not kidding, the official title is the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the point of that law was to ensure that all of the workers who came from China to build the railroads would not be allowed to stay. We wanted to make sure that once they had worked and may or may not have been paid, that we got rid of them. It's actually, interestingly, that law was on the books until the 1940s. It's one of the biggest reasons that Asian immigrants from China and Japan tend to be far more educated than a lot of other immigrant populations, because we didn't let anyone come unless they were wealthy and educated to start with. Not because they didn't want to come. So I think that there's a lot of complexity there. What we find is there's been some studies, the Pew Research Foundation did some work on religious populations and Mormonism, and they found that Mormons are far more supportive and more liberal on immigration than a lot of other kind of extremely conservative religious groups. But you know, it's a relative thing. What I have found in my experience is we like the theory as long as they stay our gardeners and our nannies and we don't talk to them and they don't take our jobs and they don't marry our daughters, as my father likes to say. My dad, who married a white woman. And so I think there's this complicated relationship, because as long as we're in a position of superiority and power, we talk about how we love the people of whatever. And they're wonderful and spiritual and such a blessing to the church, but we don't want their apartments next to our homes. And we don't want to have to see them for who they are, and we don't want to hear the painful stories, and we want to hashtag defend the family, but it's okay that families are torn apart like Asul's. It's okay that thousands of children are in a detention center, in a prison, in the middle of the desert, because they were lucky enough to pass credible fear and show that they could apply for asylum, that they were trauma victims, so they put them in prison, right? And we're not talking about those things anymore. Right, we're not actually having that conversation, and it impacts a huge percentage of our members, but it's easier not to talk about it. And so I think there is this tension and this conflict, and a lot of it comes with a lack of desire to see and to be exposed and be willing to acknowledge that it's happening interestingly, I go to Spanish work because I'm trying to work my Spanish, which is terrible. I've had two people come and ask me about immigration issues, both were from Europe. So I think we have a lot of assumptions about immigration and about immigrant populations.
Just very quickly, I think the narrative, we're storytellers, right? So it is all about narrative. I think the narrative of obeying the law and being respectful of it is not incorrect. It's just incomplete. Because when we as let's just say citizens of the United States, in this example, and Mormons, we believe in obeying the law, but implied in that is our own understanding of what liberty and freedom are. So any one of us, if we in this country were to have that liberty taken away, say, by not having enough food to eat, or our family was in severe danger, we would be very comfortable rationalizing that that trumps the law. We no longer have to be obedient to the law because our liberty is being taken away. We just refuse to apply that to anybody else. So the law is very relative to us as well. We're not sticklers to it. We just have our own kind of rubric to interpret it. And I think that narrative needs to be brought in.
I think it's also, it's easy for us to think about obeying the law in places where there is a functioning government and there is some baseline level of respect for the rule of law. But an increasing amount of the church's population does not live in that kind of country. And it shows the kind of America-centric, certainly the Articles of Faith themselves are very America-centric, and the church population and the church leadership. There are virtually no people of color represented, virtually no people from other countries represented. So that's something, obviously, that we need to work on.
Thank you. I think you bring up a good point. A good number to remember, 60 million people, the last estimate by the UN, are stateless refugees or displaced because of violence and conflict in the world, which is essentially a country's worth of people. And those affect not just countries like the Middle East and Syria, but places like Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador and Peru. Didn't know there are now cartel gang entities in Peru, that's kind of new. So I learned that this week, which was, yeah, there's a lot of people out there and it overlaps with the church population greatly.
Hi, on the rule of law issue, that I owe Don Kerwin, who's the former executive director of the Catholic Legal Immigration Network, the important distinction between rule of law and rule by law. And if we look at the Ferguson report from the Justice Department, Ferguson is ruled by law. Okay? That's not rule of law at all when you've got 60% of your population that has a warrant out for your arrest at any given moment. And immigration in the United States is the same kind of issue. It's rule by law that is not at all a respecter of the law. And speaking as someone who's been doing this for 20 plus years, immigration law these days is as much, or immigration status these days, is as much a function of luck as it is of law. And that's not rule of law.
The number one factor in whether or not your case will get, if you have an asylum, if you're a refugee applying to the United States, the number one statistical factor in whether or not you win your case is which judge you argue in front of and the city your court is in. So,
and what time it is?
What time it is? The second is whether or not you have access to an attorney.
Yes.
70% of refugees, and especially children, have no access to legal counsel at any point in time during any of their immigration proceedings. The immigration law, they've said that it's about as complex as the tax code. So if you can imagine doing a corporate audit without a lawyer or an accountant present in a language you don't speak, often interpreted into another language that you don't fully speak. When you're seven. I've actually sat in court and seen an 18-month-old child who was the respondent and was deported while being held in his arms by his mother. Technically, he was pro se, meaning no attorney present. That's not really due process. The Constitution doesn't apply in most of immigration proceedings and to most issues because you are not entitled to be here or to enter here. and therefore you're not entitled to certain levels of process. I can go on and on what doesn't apply in the immigration section, and I would invite you, maybe if you're curious about that, what does immigration proceedings actually look like from a legal standpoint, because most people are disturbed and appalled. Thank you for bringing that up.
Oh, I was just, after he's done, we have time for one more question quickly before we close.
Very quickly, I think, kind of trying to go back to the central tenet of what we're doing, these kind of facts make us very upset, and we tend to think, well, what can we do about it? Legislation's not changed, the law is just what it is. We're not, not a lawyer.
Everyone heard doesn't vote.
Right. But that's why it's trickle up. We are going to, we say that emphatically, we're going to change the face of what asylum law looks like, and we're going to do it from the bottom. We don't have to change what the rules are and the system is, but we are going to change the system. And there are ways to do that. And you can find, I mean, you can, great, come help Torchlight, but there's a million, there's so many people like us that are doing similar things. That's how it changes. That's how we, that's the place where we can put our anger.
I'm not sure if I missed this
in the beginning.
I'm not sure if I missed this.
A couple weeks ago in New York with one of the attorneys who works for Human Rights Versus, an organization the early 90s, and she said, you know, our biggest problem, honestly, our biggest need is finding translators of strange languages on short notice. And my first thought was, I know a lot of return missionaries who speak weird languages. So I think that's one place I would love to see the Mormon community. We're working with BYU a little bit. I'd love to expand that. I'm one of the bank of translators and interpreters. I would love to see people who have lost the language skill, that spoke, you know, Mandarin 100 years ago and don't really remember it, to go take a class and get back up to speed so that they can help. If you like to Google, there's a lot of great research you can do sitting in front of TV Googling your brains out. So I think what I would love to see the Mormon community is just to say, what can we do, what are we already good at, and how do we find a place for that, one person at a time. And if you want to donate money to me, I'm fine with that too.
But this is not a fundraising event, so that's not the point.
Just like to thank everybody for coming, and specifically Azul and Jennifer and Joshua.
Joseph.
It's by the end of this, my brain.